This is Icon Art Radio, broadcasting from Icon Gallery in the Fairfield Square in the Cultural District of Fairfield. I'm Bill Teeple, and we've got Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and a guest in the studio today. Our guest, Two Cents Worth person, will be Mary Snyder Behrens. Okay, Donna, you've got a quote.
Yes,
Fernand Léger. Fernand Léger. How do you pronounce that guy's name?
Fernand, I don't know if it's Léger or Léger. It's L-E-G-E-R, a French word. Okay. So anyway, something like that.
Famous French modernist.
French, and he was known for painting pipes and machine-like objects and all that, and they're just marvelous, wonderful works of art. But this is a little story about when he had gone with a friend to visit some big exhibition of paintings in Paris in their ornate gold frames and so forth. And he himself was just feeling a bit bored looking at this batch of fairly traditional paintings in the Paris Salon. And right next door, in the same exhibition hall, there was a little partition, and he peeked through, and there was an exhibition of various kinds of machinery, farm machinery and other kinds of machinery. And he went through and was absolutely enthralled by the beauty of these sculptural pieces of machinery. And also he was very enamored of the people who were in there, the workers who were setting up this exhibition. And some of them asked permission to go over to the other side and see the painting exhibition, and he took them over, and they had various reactions, and he ended up this story with this particular statement. He said, "I will always see a 16-year-old with fiery red hair, a new blue canvas coat, orange pants, and a hand spattered with Prussian blue, blissfully contemplating the nude women in gold frames. Without the slightest doubt, he, in his clothes of a modern worker, blazing with color, killed the whole exhibition. Nothing more remained on the walls than vaporous shadows in old frames. The dazzling kid, who looked as though he had been fathered by a piece of farm machinery, was the symbol of the neighboring exhibition, of the life of tomorrow, where prejudice will be destroyed." And this was probably, let's see if I can find a date on this. This was, you know, clearly at the beginning of the modern era. I don't see the date, but sometime at the beginning of the 20th century.
Oh, you think of the 20th century as modern.
Well, yeah.
Well, I'm just being difficult. When you said the modern age, I was thinking, of course, in the 1880s, they were thinking that was the modern age.
Yeah.
You know. But the era of modern art,
modernism,
we would think,
right? Yeah.
Early 20th century early 20th through about century. The 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it died as death in the right. 50s and 60s, and we had a great era of postmodernism that we're living in today.
Yes, now we are postmodern.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of places we could go with that. The prejudice will be no more is something we could take up in 2009. It brings to mind, I mean, he's really ringing the bell of the modernist vision that's beyond the stuffy, darkened nudes in the gold frame. And it makes me think of my personal experience of the blue Prussian blue or the ultramarine blue squirted out of the tube on the palette being a greater experience than anything I could possibly think of doing on the canvas, and it makes you want to just forget it, you know, because it almost seemed like you're automatically stepping the whole thing down from that beautiful blue.
But if you can get a really, really ornate gold frame, it does wonders for
well, yeah, and I think that we've given ourselves permission to just do that in the modern period.
Mm-hmm.
Yves Klein and those blue pieces by mm-hmm. Yves Klein mm-hmm. are just that. He was able to get that experience up onto the wall of the museum,
mm-hmm.
and we're all just able to
And we can also
celebrate that.
And we can also hang a frame without a painting and make
well, and that's led us to the postmodern dilemma that almost anything goes. Yeah. So there's no standards any longer. And so we have to find within ourselves the direct, true response where we can call it truly art again, and beauty is what we're talking about, which gets to my point that I bring up almost every week about the what is it, what beauty is, and that that is the essential component here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting when he was talking about the class thing, and that, you know, he's comparing those gold frames as to some sort of hierarchy in terms of, the classes that are existing there, and that the workers, were a different class. And maybe he's talking there about an industrialization being the democratizing factor here. Yeah. And did it really, was that really true, though? Did that really happen? It probably just created a different kind of class system. Mm-hmm. Surely, those frames and those bourgeois salons stopped existing, and in terms of beauty, that's probably been a good thing. I mean, no more prescribed way of approaching the making of art, at least in terms of an artist.
Yes, and earlier in the same essay by Léger, he was talking about the why does there have to be a distinction between the artist and the artisan, and he mentioned things like arrangements in store windows and bakeries and things like that that were beautiful works of art, and yet they were not considered worthy as works of art. And so he brought up all of those kinds of issues.
Well, in those days, there was definitely a hierarchy. There was definitely fine art and everything else, and the fine art were these, whatever was contained within those gold frames. And people were not looking around and seeing the blue pants on the working man as an art experience. Some people may have been, but it was that they were breaking down these prejudices. And of course, that was the age of the socialist revolution. Many artists at that period were either socialists or communists. And I think he's getting his two cents worth in there about that subject. Of course, we're out of it now. We're into the corporate art world of today, which I don't know where the socialist artist is. They're coming out of art school counting how much money they can make now.
To pay off their loans.
That's right.
But there's still those distinctions, almost like class distinctions between the crafts and the fine arts, and that, photography is really a relatively recent inductee into the fine art world, but there's still so many others that are struggling. I mean, no matter how wonderful they are, they're still going to be relegated to the craft and not to the art bin.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bill, before when you were talking about squeezing the tubes of paint out onto the... I frantically was trying to find a Kandinsky quote in this same book about exactly that, and so I did find it. So I'm going to read that now, because this was Kandinsky talking about his experience of squeezing the tubes of paint out. He said, "These unique beings we call colors, each alive in and for itself, independent, endowed with all necessary qualities for further independent life, and ready and willing at every moment to submit to new combinations, to mix among themselves and create endless series of new worlds. The palette is a curious world of the remnants of colors already used, which wander far from the source in their necessary embodiments on the canvas. Here's a world which derived from the desires of pictures already painted, desires of pictures already painted was also determined and created through accidents, through the puzzling play of forces alien to the artist. And I owe much to these accidents. They have taught me more than any teacher or master. Many an hour I studied them with love and admiration. The palette, which consists of the elements mentioned, which is itself a work and often more beautiful than many another work, should be valued for the pleasure which it offers." Yeah, it goes on. "It sometimes seems to me that the brush, which with unyielding will tore pieces from this living color creation, evoked a musical sound in this tearing process. Sometimes I heard a hissing of the colors as they were blending. It was like an experience that one could hear in the secret kitchen of the alchemist, cloaked in mystery. Kandinsky was one of the few artists who really made art with words as well as with color and form. He was very comfortable expressing these things in words.
Well, I definitely think of the colors as my friends. The colors, they're like living entities, especially like the 12 colors of the color wheel, like a yellow green is a kind of nuance of yellow green, but yellow green is like that personality to me, and I think of them as living personalities. And then there's the interactions, as he's talking about, of these different characters creating different chords, but different qualities of intelligence are at play between them, and that's how I look at their combination.
But it was interesting the way he talked about them as being willing participants in endless combinations at the will of the artist.
Right, exactly.
It almost makes you feel guilty taking them and forcing them into some. But
there's a sensual kind of allure in that too, and I think all of us who've painted remember the first time we squeezed that stuff out, and you know, either with a palette knife or a brush or something. I mean, it's this archaic kind of way of approaching artwork, you know, this old with the linseed oil and the metals all mixed together, and then we're painting it, and the smell. I mean, there's so many things. You know, I used to smoke cigarettes, and I remember when I quit, the things that I missed the most were the sounds, you know, that little spitting, you know, when they would burn. And I think about that with oil paints, all those little nuances, the smell, you know, there's a texture to that that is not, you know, in watercolor, not in acrylic. I mean, those are the things I think that artists fall in love with. There's this tactile, real thing going on there that we have fallen in love with. And I know that people like Kandinsky or Sheila or Kokoschka, I mean, when you look at their paintings, you know they love playing with that stuff. When they put that on that surface, I mean, they are just in ecstasy.
Right.
It's really just astonishing to see. Yeah.
And I think we feel as artists the responsibility of getting them from here to there without losing the integrity of the beauty that's revealing itself right on the palette. There's laws of nature that are taking place before our eyes as they mix kind of spontaneously on the palette. And then to that divine experience we're having, we feel responsible to somehow get it up there so that there can be a communion of souls around that in the gallery. And that's what the gallery is all about.
Yeah, and Bob Hornline does that consciously by putting a big sheet of canvas on his studio floor, leaving it there for a long time, and various drips fall on it and all that, and then he'll cut it up and use that as the ground for his paintings. And it's the same reason, I think, why it's so fascinating for pretty much any artist to go and visit the studio of another artist, no matter what kind of work that artist does, because all of these bits of evidence of the creative process that's left after the work is done is just as fascinating, if not more fascinating sometimes.
Well, that's why the studio sometimes is a greater work of art that contains more of the whole of than what the artist is than these parts that have been, these snapshots that we take in and display in the gallery are not as holistic necessarily in revealing the nature of the artist as that studio.
Yeah. Well, and the word evidence, I mean, that's so key in all of this, because that's what we're trying to preserve, is the evidence, you know. And I remember somebody talking to me once about doing your paintings, and he said, you know, you have to show your work. He said, you have to show the work. And I said, well, what do you mean? Because you remember math class. You could come up with the answer, but you had to show your work. He said, when you compose a painting, the history has to follow it. You have to show the work. Everybody's got to know how you got to that. And I said, well, that's a perfect analogy, you know, because you're bringing the evidence with you, whether it's in the color or the stuff. But we all have to carry the evidence from our studio floors onto the canvas, somehow.
And Bob Hornline is such a great example, because his studio contains all this. In fact, I was so moved by that whole thing, that we actually took one wall of his studio, we plotted every, because he'd pushed all these little precious things to him on this wall for maybe 2 or 5 years or 10 years, I don't know, and antlers and little studies and little drawings and various stuff that he'd collected and just pinned spontaneously on the wall. I thought that was so beautiful. I had him plot it, and we transferred that entire wall over to the old gallery, and one of the walls was that, because there was just more in that. Well, it amplified. What it did was it brought evidence of the creation of these works because of the fact, because we had his showing, but we also had the wall from his studio there. He also had other pieces that had been in the studio laying this way and that. We brought those and put them here this way and that in the show also, and it seemed more complete to do it that way.
Well, I remember a story about Giacometti never ever threw anything away, and the corners of his studio were just piled with empty tubes of paint, and I thought, oh, what a rich little setting. Dusty, I'm sure, but how rich, you know, that he's maintained, you know, and kept all that evidence of past paintings.
Picasso was the same way, and he wound up with, you know, something like 7 apartments or houses at the end of his life filled with stuff that he just kind of had to leave that and go to a new space. But I think one of my favorite art books that I own is it's a book of black and white photographs by David Douglas Duncan, who was one of the main Picasso photographers from probably the 1960s. And it's called The Private World of Pablo Picasso. This photographer lived with Picasso and his wife Jacqueline for a period of time and just photographed every corner of the house, and the entire house was a studio essentially, and it was just like that. You know, you saw these things piled on in the corner, you saw him eating fish for dinner and eating the fish off the fish bones, and then you see the fish bones lying on a plate, and then you see a piece of ceramic art that he did where he used the fish bones as the forms, and, you know, so you see the sequence of how he, in living his life, he had sparks for making something, and all of these funny little sculptures that he just made out of bits of wood that he found here and there in the junkyard and all that, and then you'd see the pieces that he'd taken that from lying on the shelf, and so it's a marvelous book.
I can't help going back to the idea of the paint coming out of the tube, because in my media, the analogy to that is a Hamburg Steinway or a Bösendorfer or something, and just one strike of the C below middle C, or 2 octaves below middle C, just hit that note and hold it and let the piano do its thing with that one note. And as far as I'm concerned, that's as compelling and engaging and worthwhile as a symphony. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing that such a thing could exist. And it's just, you know, as soon as you start painting the painting, you know, that note gets mixed in with all the others and you have a whole different experience. But it's really, I mean, I can be stopped cold by the first note when I'm about to make a new piece. I'll hit a note and I'll think, well, I can't improve on that. So much for this session.
I think it's very much what Mary's doing with her torn paper series. It's the ones that I think blow my mind the most is what that one or two little pieces of paper that make the tiniest little statement. But all of them pretty much are at least very concentrated expressions, like a few notes. And you can see where all her larger body of work extends out of that and amplifies it and doesn't get away from it. That's what I like about your work. It stays under control, but it has all that layering. But I can see where each of those is like a little sutra or a little point that the larger works could expand from. Because the torn paper ones are very much that experience for me that we're talking about.
And then, but the limiting the color, you know, and it's found color, you know, not poured out of a tube anymore. And I don't know if that's more modern or not, but, you know, I think about some of the, you know, the cultures that did gather, you know, found things and, you know, bind things together to create little shrines or whatever. When I do those little torn paper things, I think about that, you know, the found papers and things like that. You know, I want to get back to that business about the, you know, the machine, you know, with Léger. And really, I mean, he turned everything he did, every landscape, into something that looked very machine-like. You know, I mean, that really was his thing. And I think about, you know, Charles Scheeler doing that too, you know, in some of his paintings, very moving into this new century. And I wonder who now, you know, is doing stuff that is pushing the envelope there for what's coming next in our culture, you know, in our mechanized post-mechanization. I guess it's a cyber culture or whatever. I mean, he was really pushing that envelope, going from those, you know, Rubens, you know, those flowery paintings to this hard edge, you know, steely kind of gritty thing.
But he was also acknowledging, and Scheler too, the beauty of modern civilization and the industrial age. Up to this point, I think everyone was reacting to it and thinking, "Oh, this is the end of beauty."
But if you look at the early industrial stuff, you know, they spent as much time on the wrought iron filigree as they did on the structural elements in the bridge.
But I think that when we got past the having to decorate it.
Yeah.
To just the pipes themselves, the really functional pipes.
Right.
I think he and Scheler were also were saying, "Look at how beautiful this is."
Yeah, it's
and that was a change
beautiful.
In consciousness. I mean, they helped shift consciousness into loving the beauty of functional objects.
Yeah,
and I'm sure I don't know what the analogy is today exactly.
Well, that would have moved, you know, them towards the streamlining things, and that whole Art Deco period, which totally changed the way we look at architecture, the way, you know, it's not that same kind of Gothic stuff. So, I mean, he really had this incredible impact, but I have no idea what that would be today. I mean, today everything is just all over everything is new, you know.
I guess now we really are looking at what the artist brings to it more than what it is. It's the extent to which you can find something below the surface is really what determines whether it's of interest or not. I mean, the post-postmodern direction seems to me that it has to go back to the self. It has to go back to the artist. Because we've accepted the idea that, you know, anything can be art, and that anything that you do creatively with anything is, in a sense, what postmodernism is. Let's build a suit of armor out of credit cards, literally anything you can think of, except the emphasis has been on make sure it's something no one's ever seen before. And the irony is that what we really want to see is something that we probably have seen before. Maybe we only glimpsed it, but it's something that we yearn for. And to find that in a work of art is far more memorable than seeing something that's just unique for the sake of being unique.
Well, I think also this is such an information age. We are absolutely inundated with facts and explanations about everything, and you know, you have a little question about anything, you can go and find the answer to it in 2 minutes on the internet. I think that the quality that people seem to be yearning for these days is the mystery, like getting back to something, your little trammel boxes, mm-hmm. I think, are appealing to people these days, especially because so much is just like blatantly out in the open now, mm-hmm. that the aspects of life that are hidden somehow nourish us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not necessarily hidden, simply not susceptible to definition, mm-hmm. and, you know, depiction.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that we know that we will never, ever be able to say or express. And we sort of are inundated by definitions and things that are conceptual and linguistic. And there's another whole domain of life that is beyond conceptualization and beyond language. And it's a shame to, you know, forget that it even exists, which I think is what the modern world, our current modern world, is telling us.
Well, you touched on something that, you know, you said, well, you know, everything is art, you know, and anything can be art. And maybe the model has to be that we step back from that, mm-hmm. and we try to redefine, you know, what is art, and not be so inclusive. Because once you start being so inclusive, I mean, the value of it all drops out.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, maybe art needs to, I mean, I've always thought that to be a valid work of art, it had to at least transcend its materiality. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of stuff that does that. I mean, at least not that I can see. But, you know, again, you know, it's eye of the beholder and the intelligence of the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
Well, so. You know, I think this is our point we've been discussing for about eight. I mean, this is what I've been getting at in the last 100 shows here, is this point. I think it's very important, and I think what we're talking about here is that Leger and Schiller were part of that opening up to seeing everything as beautiful, seeing the world around us, every aspect of every industrial, everything. And now I think we're coming to closure on that. We have to start to discriminate again. What is beauty? What is the difference between something of deep intrinsic value and everyday of just some stuff?
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.